This is November 4th at 10 o'clock with interview with Colonel Stan Brigadier and interviewer Jatani Gunnarsson. Yes.
Okay, well, I will start at the very beginning.
Right.
I was born on the 6th of June. That's a famous date because it's D-Day. But I was 6 years old on the 6th day of the 6th month of the 6th year of the war. So I got 4 sixes in a row. 6th of June 1938 in a small farming community about 50 miles north of Edmonton, Alberta, a community called Thorhild, Alberta. And I was born in a log farmhouse of my grandmother's. Flash forward about another 18 years, I lived around the central Alberta and ended up just out on the outskirts of Edmonton, went to high school at a place called Salisbury High School, which is now known as Sherwood Park. And I joined the Royal Canadian Navy in 1957, right after high school, and attended a naval college, a two-year naval college in Victoria, under what was called the Venture Officer Training Plan. And in that program, it was an academic program of 2 years long, and during those 2 years, in each winter, we did a cadet training cruise to familiarize ourselves with the Navy, a little in operational indoctrination to give us an incentive, because working in a classroom every day for months on end, it gets pretty boring. So this was kind of a way the Navy kept you interested in your future. In my junior year, we did the last foreign cruise done by the cruiser Ontario on the west coast. It went to Panama, and while we were in Panama, our divisional officer arranged passage on a cruise ship through the Panama Canal from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean. When we got to the other side, we took a train that went through the jungle through Panama back to Panama City on the Pacific side, where we rejoined our cruiser and then sailed back up the west coast of North America back to Victoria, stopping off at Acapulco in Mexico, did a few days there, and saw those famous divers that dive off these high cliffs when the water rushes into these pools, and they dive off, time their diving so that they hit it when the water's at their height. Very interesting. That was something very significant in the 50s and 60s, apparently. We stopped in San Diego, and at San Diego, those of us who were interested in aviation did a tour of the aircraft carrier Bennington, and that's the first time any of us had ever seen an aircraft carrier. Very, very exciting. In my senior year, I was fortunate to be assigned the position of Chief Cadet Captain. Our cadet organization was designed into 4 divisions. Each division had a senior cadet as a cadet captain, and then there was one chief cadet captain in charge of all the cadets, and it just happened to be me. I was also awarded the top athlete of the college in my senior year. So I played a lot of sports, and I was pretty good at them. And I still golf regularly. In our senior year, with the cruiser now being decommissioned, we did our cruise on Prestonian-class frigates. There were 4 frigates assigned to a training squadron. I was in the squadron commander's frigate, HMCS Sussex Vale, and we did a cruise to Hawaii, Fiji, the Samoan Islands, back through San Diego, and then back to Victoria. A really very interesting and very motivating for young cadets. And those trips, besides being motivational and training, they were there to indoctrinate us into what the non-commissioned members of a ship's crew did. We would spend 2 weeks in each of the departments, 2 weeks with the supply department, 2 weeks with the engineers, oiling the engines and doing all the things that able seamen and leading seamen do and all that. So we would learn their jobs and know what those people who would be our subordinates eventually, when we were commissioned, we would know what their jobs were, and we would know their working environment. I think the Navy had an outstanding training program. In our senior year, the Navy did another extremely smart thing. They sent all of us who had passed our aircrew selection boards, which was done with the Air Force previously, because the Air Force did all the air training in Canada. We were sent to the Victoria Flying Club to get a private pilot's license. And those of us who passed that were then sent to the Air Force after we graduated in our senior year, were sent to the Air Force for pilot training. Normally in pilot training with the Air Force, they lose about 50% before they come to wing standards. 50% fail the course somewhere along the way. With our 19 students with our course, not one of us failed. And it was because we were washed out, those who wouldn't have made it, were washed out in the private pilots course, which was a very inexpensive way of washing out those who weren't suitable. So that was a very smart thing for the Navy to do. In my flying training, we went to the Air Force and did the primary training at Centralia, Ontario, just for a few weeks, Penhold, Alberta, and Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. When I was in Penhold, one little event occurred to me. I think I was the only one who had a real emergency in an airplane out of my course. I took off one day, and as I was climbing through about 2,000 feet, going on a solo flight, I had now reached the solo stage, so I didn't have an instructor with me, and my propeller hub failed, and all the oil came out, and I didn't have an airplane running very well. I had to throttle back the engine. The propeller was losing oil, and I wasn't going to fly for more than a couple more minutes. Very fortunately, I'd just taken off, so the airfield was just a couple of miles behind me, and I turned her back and landed the airplane. And I did it quite well, so I got one of these good show awards in the flight safety world of the Air Force. Then we went from Penhold in the wintertime, and actually that was quite a fortunate place to be, because Penhold is only about an hour and a half from Edmonton, where my parents lived. So on weekends, I could go home to where my parents were and spend some time. Although it was in the wintertime, and it was bloody cold that year, I remember. And in 1960, in the summer, we did our advanced training, multi-engine training in Saskatoon. And we didn't do jet training, because the Navy wasn't training any jet pilots at that time, because they were getting ready to phase out the Banshee jet fighter that was in the Navy. So they were just training multi-engine and then eventually helicopter pilots. So went to Saskatoon to do multi-engine training and graduated in 1960 with their wings, in September with their wings. One of the things, the incidents I remember there, one of the first, what they call solo flights, but you don't go solo in a C-45 Beechcraft, but you go without an instructor, so two students together. And the last thing my instructor said was, don't forget to switch your nose tank. You know, only feed one engine off your nose tank and another engine off a different tank. They have about three different tanks, fuel tanks. Well, I guess we didn't listen very well, because we're feeding both engines off the nose tank, and it ran down. And as we were flying over the city of Saskatoon, about 3,000 feet over the city, all of a sudden both engines quit. You can imagine our hearts just going right up into our throat. Of course, we knew what happened, so we quickly changed tanks and restarted the engines and landed back safely at Saskatoon. That was quite interesting. Just to go back to our flying in Centralia, the primary aircraft was called the Chipmunk. In Penhold, the what they call the basic flying course was the Harvard. And in Saskatoon, of the C-45 Expeditor that we did the multi-engine training on. In 1960, after we got our wings, we went to the one and only Canadian Naval Air Station, which was Shearwater, in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Dartmouth is a twin city of Halifax. In fact, today I think they're all combined. That was in 1960. We did a tracker conversion course, and the tracker, CS2F Tracker, is a twin-engine, four-person anti-submarine airplane that is basically for carrier use. The Canadian Navy bought 100 of these airplanes in about 56 from the Grumman Aircraft Corporation. but they were actually built under license at de Havilland in Toronto. So it's actually Canadian built, but it's a U.S. airplane. U.S. was building these by the thousands, because all their ASW carriers were flying this particular airplane. So we did the conversion onto the Tracker aircraft, ready for operational employment. And during that period of time, we also did a Winterbush survival course and a sea survival course. Sea survival being very important for people who fly at sea. We joined AD-80, the operational squad, in the spring of 61, and they had a really good program of a four-year tour. When you joined the squadron, you joined up with a crew commander, you were a co-pilot, you joined up with a crew commander and two naval air crewmen who were your basically equipment operators, non-commissioned equipment operators. And you spent 1 year ashore doing shore-based operations and training for sea duty. Your second year was at sea as a co-pilot, what we call the operational side of the squadron, because sea duty was operations. Then in your third year, you came ashore, this time now as a crew commander, you got another co-pilot to be your co-pilot, and two new crewmen, and you formed up, this crew stayed together for 2 years. You spent 1 year ashore again as a crew commander, then back to sea 1 year. My shore time was quite short, because I was pretty good at flying, I guess, and my crew commander when I was ashore, or when I first joined the squadron, was a squadron operations officer, and he had to do quite a lot of sea duty, so I didn't spend a full year ashore as a co-pilot. I spent more than a year and a half at sea, and then as a crew commander, my 2 years, where one was supposed to be ashore, I only spent about 6 months ashore, and again, a year and a half at sea on the carrier. So that's the way it works with sometimes. I was very fortunate that I had the squadron operations officer as my crew commander. He was an extremely experienced pilot. His name was Doc Shelley, and I say he was very experienced. I would just cover the fact that we flew from our Canadian aircraft carrier, HMCS Bonaventure, and during the period 61 to 65, that I was in the 8A squadron, the operational squadron, I also flew from three American carriers. When our carrier was occasionally in refit for short periods, we would deploy to an American carrier, A, to keep up our proficiency, but B, to get this, as part of NATO, to get familiarized with their procedures and familiarize them with our procedures. They wouldn't ever deploy to our carrier, because our carrier was half the size of even the smallest American carrier. When we went to their carriers, we were very pleased to have this huge carrier to fly from. Our carrier was a 20,000-ton carrier. Their smallest was 45,000 tons, which was the normal, considered large carrier of the Second World War, the 45,000-ton carrier. Today, those carriers don't exist. The U.S. Navy has 90 to 100,000-ton carriers. And those are the huge ones. So we used to deploy to these carriers, and I flew from the Essex, USS Essex, Watts, and Intrepid back in the 64-65 time frame. A couple of incidents I'd like to relate. In 1962, I remember in the spring, we were taking a formation of four airplanes down to Bermuda to do a training exercise. And we were supposed to fly down in the daytime, and the Tracker does not have good navigation for long-range flying. It's a short-range airplane, 5 hours duration, designed to stay close to your carrier or land. So we're flying a long trip like that, so we don't have long-range navigation systems. You navigate what we call by dead reckoning. Dead reckoning means see the water, gauge the wind, there are wind finding procedures, you know your airspeed, so you just plot your course. Well, we couldn't take off from Sherwood in daytime because it was 0-0 in fog. Zero visibility, zero ceiling, right on the ground. Finally, as the late afternoon came upon us in the winter, it was starting to get dark, the fog lifted, and we had to get to Bermuda. So we couldn't go in formation, can't fly a Tracker at night in formation. It's not a formation airplane to start with. It's even lousy in the daytime, but one airplane could lead them down the daytime and you all kind of gaggle onto each other. No way at night. So we flew down on what you call on an instrument flight plan, just like all the airliners do going from Toronto to Vancouver. So we took off and climbed up to about 9,000 feet under an instrument flight plan with the New York Oceanic. But you can't navigate very well up there because A, you can't see the water. We don't have long-range navigation systems. So I'm plotting based on what the weatherman says the winds are expected to be at 9,000 feet for the 750-mile trip to Bermuda. Well, he doesn't have really any idea what they're going to be like down there because there's no real system of finding the winds. So he said that we're going to have a west wind. So I plotted our course to bias ourselves to the west. After about 4 hours of flying, we should be about 50 miles from Bermuda. Guess what? No Bermuda. And all we have for navigation, for short range, you have a, what you call it, tactical navigation. It's a line of sight, which means not over the horizon, line of sight, UHF radio, TACNAV system. And it's used all over the world for short range near airports, VOR or TACAD it's called. And it's line of sight. So the higher you are, the farther you'll be able to see it, just like radar. And we have an automatic direction finder, ADF, which picks up low frequency beacons. Well, we should normally pick up a low frequency beacon, but we were in bad weather, a series of thunderstorms. And in thunderstorms, you can't pick up low frequency beacons. It's just one of those phenomena about radio. So no radio beacon and thunderstorms and no TACAN. Nothing on radar. So my crew commander says, okay, Stan, what are we going to do? I'm the navigator. I'm the co-pilot. I said, well, I biased ourselves to the west. Bermuda's got to be to the east. So I said, turn 70 degrees. It's going to be ahead of you. My guess is 100 miles. Well, we flew for about 10 minutes. All of a sudden, we got into radar and TACAN range. At 70 miles, there it was on the nose. However, our low fuel warning lights come on now. That means dry tanks in not more than about 40 to 45 minutes. And engines have been known to fail after 15 minutes of the lights coming on. You're now going on cups of fuel. Well, we landed, and I'm sure we didn't have more than a couple of cups of fuel left in the tanks. So that was a very apprehensive time. Now, all the time we were doing this, we also had St. Elmo's fire. So if you think being lost is just bad enough, St. Elmo's fire is you build up static electricity on your airplane, and your whole windscreen is streaked with fire. It's just streaks coming off, and it looks like you're burning up. That's called St. Elmo's fire. That's, you know, it's scary enough being lost, but it's really scary when you think you're on fire as well. You don't know where Bermuda is. Another thing that was in our minds, in this was 62, in 1959, a trip very similar to this, but just one airplane, had gone down to Bermuda and missed it and had to ditch at night, Canadian Tracker. Fortunately, all the crew got out and a German freighter picked them up and we lost an airplane, but we didn't lose the crew. So that was in our back of our minds, because we had lost the crew going down there. This time we were four airplanes, and we kind of spread out all looking for Bermuda, but we found it. So that was a big Tracker experience. That same year, in the fall of 62, we sailed in September for the United Kingdom to do an exercise in UK waters. About 600 miles from the UK, my crew commander, who was the boss of the detachment at sea, had to fly into London to take the supply officer to make arrangements for some resupply and some refitting, because the carrier had been built in the UK, and there's some lot of equipment that needed to be refurbished while we were over there. So we launched off for the UK, about 600 miles away. That's about as far a distance as you want to stretch your Tracker's legs anyway. And we landed in the UK, got into London, and spent the night in a hotel, and went up to our defense liaison staff offices the next day, and we were going to fly to Portsmouth that day, and then the following day fly back to the carrier. And she should have been 300 miles away. Well, they said, say goodbye to your carrier. She's now 1,000 miles away. He said, how come? The night that we had launched in the afternoon, that night, and the chartered airliner, chartered to the American Air Force, had ditched in the sea with 70 passengers on board, and the carrier had turned around to the ditching position to act as the search and rescue on-scene commander for a whole bunch of ships in the middle of the ocean that were recovering these people. It's amazing, of the 70 people on board, 50 of them survived. And it was a rough sea as well in this ditching. So Bonaventure was picking up survivors, and all of the ships who had picked up the deceased, the dead bodies, were transferring them to Bonaventure using Bonaventure's helicopter. And Bonaventure then had to go to stay in the area for about 5 or 6 days, and then went to Shannon, Ireland to deposit the bodies. And then she was supposed to go to Portsmouth, and after that to the Netherlands. The Navy was going to cancel the visit to the Netherlands. They said, we're 2 weeks behind schedule and we just can't do it. And in the meantime, I was in London. We'd flown down to Portsmouth to wait for the ship. We were there for a few days. And diplomatic intervention ordered the Navy to continue with a trip to the Netherlands, because it was the first large-scale Canadian Navy visit to the Netherlands since the war, 1962. This is, that's 17 years after the war. And I think we all in Canada know how grateful the Netherlands people are for the liberation of Holland by the Canadian First Army during the Second World War. So they said it would not be possible for us to cancel that visit. We had to go, because royalty was involved with our visit and everything. So we had to go. So the carrier sent us a message that says, we can't stop to recover you. We're not doing any flying ops. We're going at high speed to the Netherlands. You guys fly over there and wait for us. So, you know, here I was in London for a few days, in Portsmouth for a few days. Now we flew to Holland and waited for the carrier for a few days. Thankfully, all at the Queen's expense. We were living in hotels and waiting for the ship. It was good fun for us. Harry arrived in Rotterdam, and we stayed in a hotel and went back aboard ship. And then after we had all the, there were receptions, and you couldn't believe how well the people of the Netherlands, I'm loath to call them the Dutch. I'm not sure why they're called Dutch, because I think that's a bastardization of the German word Deutschland. And, you know, so anyway, we call them Dutch. The Dutch people were extremely gracious. I remember one evening we were at our hotel just before the carrier actually had arrived in Rotterdam, and another couple of airplanes had actually come ashore and were with us. So we had about three crews there, and we all went out to dinner one night to an Indonesian restaurant. Apparently there's quite a few in the Netherlands. Remember that the Dutch East Indies were, what is Indonesia today. So there's quite a lot of Indonesian influence in the Netherlands. So we went to this Indonesian restaurant, and while we were there, the waiter asked who we were and where we were from and all that, and he tied us to the fact that there's big rescue by a Canadian carrier, and we were the Canadian crews and everything. So we told him, the manager came over after dinner was over, there was no charge for the dinner. And then he took all of us to his private club where there was singing and dancing and drinking and carousing and a lot, all at no expense to us. It was absolutely incredible. And this was the kind of hospitality that all of us received while we were in the Netherlands. It was just phenomenal. So that's my Netherlands visit in 1962. After we left the Netherlands, we went back to Portsmouth, because we still had to do this little bit of refit of the equipment that had been built in the UK. So while we were in Portsmouth doing this little bit of refitting work, the Cuban Missile Crisis came upon us. That's the fall of 1962. If you'll remember, it was President Kennedy who was the President of the United States, and Nikita Khrushchev was the chairman of the Soviet Union at the time. So there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, if most people are aware, that Russia was installing ballistic missiles in Cuba, and American spy planes, U-2 spy planes flying over Cuba, discovered these sites that were being prepared for the missiles, and Russian freighter ships were carrying these missiles on their decks, covered with tarpaulins and that, and were on their way to Cuba. And the Americans blockaded Cuba, set up an arc about 500 or 600 miles northeast of Cuba, blockaded Cuba, sending up an arc about 500 or 600 miles northeast of Cuba, which is just southeast of Bermuda, and set up an arc and said they weren't going to allow Russian ships with missiles on board to go beyond that arc. This was the closest the world has ever come to World War III. It was that serious. Anyway, while we were in England, the Cuban crisis came upon it, and we were ordered back to Halifax at high speed. So we left Portsmouth to go back to Halifax. But while we were in Portsmouth, of course, we were expected to be there about 10 days, and we were cut short. Some of the crew from the ship and the squadrons were on leave in London. So we left one destroyer behind, and the carrier and the others, I think there were about three more destroyers with us, sailed quickly to Halifax, and that one destroyer stayed behind to pick up all the people coming back from leave, from all those ships in the squadron. And it actually practically caught up to us in Halifax, because the carrier could only travel at 20 knots. It was a slow carrier. And the destroyer could travel at nearly 30 knots. And he had to go from Portsmouth to the Azores to refuel, and he could make Azores to Halifax without refueling. And at high speed, it got to Halifax just a few hours behind us. We got into Halifax and refueled, put our a war stock of ammunition on board, and we sailed then, the ship sailed with the destroyers to position north of the American embarkation line, which is a little bit east, northeast of Bermuda. My crew commander, was the detachment commander of the sea detachment, and myself stayed behind for a couple of days. I was doing some trials with the experimental squad in VX-10 on a new acoustic detection system that we put into the tracker. And so we had to stay behind for a couple of days, and the carrier gave us a rendezvous position. In 2 days' time, this is where we'll be. Meet you there. Fine. So 2 days later, or 2.5 days later, we launched for that position. We got to that position, and guess what? No carrier. Of course, the carrier's on radio silence now. This is real pre-war operations. No sound from the carrier. So we said, well, what do we do now? So we, of course, in order to do good navigation, you always fly close to the water, 500 feet or 1,000 feet, and that's no higher than 1,000 feet. So we climbed up several thousand feet to increase our radar range, looking for the carrier. Nothing on radar. So our senior crewman, Chief Petty Officer Saunders, finally belted out a message and said, carrier, we're here. Where are you? We've got an hour's fuel left. So they had to break radio silence to tell us where they were, and it was about another hour's flying time away. So we flew to the carrier, and of course, about halfway there from that position, on come our red lights again. We landed on the carrier with probably 10 minutes of fuel left, if that, I'm sure. This is the fall of 62, and this is only about 5 months after the same thing happened to us going to Bermuda in the spring of 62. And I said, I sure hope this isn't going to be a habit. By the way, that never happened again.
Okay.
Landed on a carrier with almost no fuel, so those are two really close calls. I mentioned the American carriers. We flew from Wasp, Essex, and Essex, Intrepid already. We came ashore in the spring of 63, and I became a crew commander. My boss came out to the West Coast, actually, to be CEO of a small squadron in Victoria, and I became crew commander. I picked up a co-pilot by the name of Ross Hawkes, who happened to be the cousin of a well-known parliamentarian from Calgary, Conservative member Jim Hawkes. Anyway, Ross and I flew together for 2 years, and I had two naval air crewmen, leading seaman Al Downey, whose son today is an inspector with the Spanish Police Department. Quite a coincidence. And another able seaman, Joe Pilgrim. Joe McCaffrey, not Joe Pilgrim. Joe McCaffrey. In spring of 64, we did a first real important trip. We went to the Mediterranean on an exercise. And while we're in the Mediterranean, we were in Gibraltar and we visited France. And while we're in the Mediterranean, after close to the end of the exercise, we were en route to Lisbon for a port call when the Cyprus peacekeeping force was being set up. This was a UN operation, and Bonaventure was recalled to Halifax, so we didn't make the Lisbon port visit. We turned and headed straight to Halifax to pick up the army, because we were tasked to be the transport ship for all of the Canadian Army vehicles that were going to Cyprus. A large contingent of Canadian Army was going there as peacekeepers. That was our really second big, and I think we've only done two really big peacekeeping operations, Suez in 56 and Cyprus in 64. And this was the second big one, Cyprus in 64. And so we got into Halifax, and of course all of us in the squadron thought that we would never we wouldn't sail with the ship because we were a squadron. They couldn't take the squadron and the army equipment. Well, the admiral said, yes, you can. He said, I'm not sailing a carrier without airplanes. So we secured all the army equipment and the airplanes in the hangar, on the flight deck. Everything was chock-a-block full of airplanes and army equipment, trucks and armored personnel carriers and everything. I think we had about 80 or 90 soldiers on board. Most of the ones who were operational, these were drivers and maintenance personnel. Most of the operational soldiers had flown over to Cyprus. We were coming a little later with their equipment. Mm-hmm. So we sailed in about around the 1st of March for Cyprus, stopped in Gibraltar for fuel. As we're passing through the Med, south of Italy and Sicily, we actually ran into a sandstorm from the Sahara Desert. It was quite a distance at sea off the coast of North Africa, but the south wind was blowing all the sand right over the Mediterranean. Quite amazing. So we went through the sandstorm and eventually arrived in Cyprus at Famagusta Harbor and offloaded all these army equipment. We sailed from there, I remember, on April Fool's Day, the 1st of April 64, which we did our first carrier recalls, got everybody back up to speed on carrier landings and recalls. We hadn't flown for over a month. On the way back from Cyprus, I remember well the family saying that the Admiral in Halifax promised that we would come straight back to Halifax, because we had been away now for over 3 months with that very short pause to pick up Army equipment. We were going to be, another month away by the time we got back to Halifax. We had to stop in Malta to pick up fuel, pay a little port visit in Malta. And I think we may have stopped even in Gibraltar on the way back as well. And then the long transit across the Atlantic. Well, somebody had had arranged to do jet fighter trials on board the carrier on the way back. Instead of coming to Halifax, we went to Norfolk, Virginia. The Navy, this was 64, and the Navy had decommissioned the Banshee fighters that we used to have in the Navy in 1962. And they were still looking around for a fighter that might be suitable for the carrier. And there was a small jet fighter called the A-4 Skyhawk, small delta wing fighter, much smaller than the Banshee was. Very, very effective airplane, actually. The U.S. Navy had it for years. And they arranged trials. So we went to Norfolk and we got two A4Es on board and we went to sea and did trials. I was a landing signals officer, and that's the guy that stands on the back near the round down of the carrier and helps the pilots land. You get trained for this and you have a trained eye that knows whether the airplane's in the right position to land, he's got the right speed and he's approaching it correctly, and you're talking to him on a radio, and if he's not in the right position you wave him off and you tell him he can't land and he has to go around again. So, you know, it's pilot and the LSO work together to make sure he's in the right position to land. So I was helping the USN LSO with his, because they had to bring an LSO trained with the jets. I wasn't. But I knew all the procedures, and I was his carrier expert on our carrier. So we did these A4E trials, and while the trials were pretty good and the weather was pretty good, we found that the A4 wasn't suitable because it had a very narrow undercarriage. And we actually tipped one over by the carrier turning out of wind one time or something, and it heeled over, and the actual airplane tipped over onto its wing, which proved that it wasn't suitable for a small carrier. It was okay on big carriers because big carriers don't have much deck motion in the sea state, unless it's a really rough sea, and then they would tie the airplanes down anyway. But if it's just an average sea, you have to be able to operate in those conditions. Well, Bonaventure was such a small carrier that there was always a lot of deck motion. Even in a, almost a calm sea, there was a lot of deck motion. The airplane that we flew, the Tracker, it didn't matter what kind of a sea, it could handle anything. It was really good. Perfect carrier airplane. But you couldn't put a high performance, a high speed airplane, and especially one with a narrow tricycle, on a small carrier like that. So that didn't work out. But anyway, another event happened. As we were leaving the Norfolk area to go home, one night I launched for a night flight, and there were four airplanes there, but we used to launch four at a time, and we were leaving on task, those four would be holding over the ship while you launched so that they could land, because you can't land and launch airplanes at the same time on a small carrier. You got to get the four off, and then you've got room to land the other four. So we launched, and then those other four who had been airborne for 4 hours were supposed to land. So I launched and flew out for about a half an hour, and I lost all my electrics. Everything went black in the airplane. Well, that's not good, especially down in those waters, because at night down there, it's just as black as an inkwell. There is no horizon. So you can't fly visual. You're flying instruments. You've got to have your instruments. No instruments. We have a very small emergency light that operates off a battery. And so that could point to my instruments, and I could read the air pressure instruments, which didn't require an electrics, like your altitude. So I had an altitude, and I could tell from the, there's a vertical meter that tells you whether you're going up or down. So I could tell whether I was going up or down. I could see my altitude. So if my altimeter was going down, I was descending. So with those, I was keeping track of my spatial orientation. My co-pilot had an emergency gyro that runs off the battery, but it's just a tiny, tiny little, it's a real emergency. And with this tiny little red light shining, you can hardly see it. But he could help me keep the airplane level. So we came back to the ship and said, hey, I need a recovery. I can't go and do my job. I ain't got electrics. Can't operate my radar. Can't operate anything. It's a good thing my engines are still working. Well, when I got back to the carrier, about 40 minutes, I had been out before, there were three airplanes going around the ship. They should have landed right after I launched. I said, that's strange. But they didn't say anything. They just gave me a holding position and said, we'll recover you shortly. I had lots of gas. But these guys, I said, they're on fumes. Anyway, shortly after I got back, they landed those three airplanes. And then they gave me a landing signal and said, come on in and land. I tried about three or four visual approaches, and I just couldn't get set up visually. I couldn't get my airplane in the right attitude. I don't mean attitude like people talk to each other, but attitude means the height of your nose up and down, and it's got to be at the right position so that your gear hits the carrier deck first before your nose gear does, your main landing gear after. So you got to have your nose up just in the right position. That's what we call attitude. And I just couldn't get it set up. And you'll always get it right, you get the right airspeed, but I just couldn't get it back. Finally, the radar operator on the carrier, we had carrier control approach, same as ground control approach on an airfield. And he says, can I help? He said, let me set you up about 10 miles back. So that's what he did. And that allowed me to slow the airplane down. In fact, I had my co-pilot do it on his little mini gyro. And we got the airplane set up at the right speed, and I took over just as we hit the glide slope, and I descended to the carrier, and I finally made my landing successfully. Here I am. So that was a very exciting night. Now, when I landed, And we went inside, and I said, what the heck were those three airplanes doing up there an hour after they were supposed to land? What they didn't tell me was, when those airplanes came down to land after we had launched, the first one had gone over the side, and the airplane was lost in the sea, but the four crew got out, and they were doing the rescue operation. But they didn't tell me. They didn't want to scare me. So that's why the other three airplanes were held airborne until they recovered the crew that were in the water, and then they landed those airplanes. So that was an exciting night. Well, we finished that tour in 880, and I think things go a little faster now. In 65, I left the squadron, and I became a simulator instructor in the tracker. But the airplanes were being modernized from a Mark II tracker to a Mark IIA to a Mark II. We were upgrading them in two stages. And the simulator wasn't keeping up. So after 1 year, we closed the simulator down. So I got posted to the experimental squadron, VX-10, where I was for 3.5 years. And it was still all at Shearwater from 61 to 69. I was in the VX-10 from 66 to 69. Most of my work was doing the tracker upgrade testing as it came back from the manufacturer onto the base. I did most of the flight testing to see that all the equipment worked with the way it was refurbished. I was also the project officer for the, and they put a stable platform in it, which was a system which was designed to give you a better heading and attitude reference system. And you could also then fly the airplane in the north using the true reference system instead of magnetic, because in the north, you can't really fly in magnetic, because magnetic north isn't north. You know, magnetic north is near Resolute, Cornwallis Island in the north, which is quite a few hundred miles from the North Pole. Mm-hmm. So when you get that far north, you have to have a different reference system, like True North. So, as a matter of fact, I think it was 68, there was a United States icebreaker, tanker with an ice-breaking capability was going to transit the Northwest Passage. And Canada, to show sovereignty of the North, sent two trackers to the North to follow it and provide ice reconnaissance for the Manhattan. I was the project officer for this stable platform in VX-10. 880 was the squadron that was going to fly, but I had to provide the two airplanes to them because they couldn't take a normal airplane with a magnetic compass system. They had to take one with a stable platform system that could give them a true reference and fly in the north using maps that read in true, and they didn't use the magnetic reference. So I prepared those airplanes for them, and they went to the north successfully. They had some very serious incidents, but they flew up north following this Manhattan voyage. That's well written up, by the way, in history books, if anyone wants to read about the Manhattan voyage. It's about 68. While I was in VX-10, again, I did the crash test. In 67, Bonaventure did an extensive refit, and they refurbished the catapult and the arrestor gear. They replaced the mirror landing system with a Fresnel lens system, which is a much more stable light projection to help pilots do the glide slope and land on the carrier. And I did a lot of the project work with that. And then in 68, the carrier was coming up from a cruise down south, and I flew down to Florida, Miami actually, and flew from ashore because apparently she was purging her tanks for another refit, a short refit, and couldn't take fuel. So we had to fly from ashore out to the carrier, do some trials, back ashore to U.S. bases, and refuel, spend the night. Next night, do the same thing. We're doing night white lighting trials. Our airplanes had red light for the instruments. And red light is good because it doesn't destroy your night vision. And if you're a patrol airplane at sea, you want to have good night vision so you can see the ocean. And if you're looking for submarines, sometimes they'll be snorkeling their snorkel up, and they'll create a phosphorescent wake. You can actually see that for miles and miles. So you always want to have night vision. Well, but red lighting is very hard to focus on, really hard. So they put in an airplane, they put in blue filtered white lighting. And they, and that wasn't too bad on your night vision, but it was, and it was really good to read. They also put white dustpan lighting on the carrier as a trial, so that the carrier deck could be floodlit, but they put dustpans over top so the light didn't shine up or anything, so that, for example, a submarine looking at you from 8 or 10 miles away wouldn't be able to see the light. Because that's the last thing a carrier wants to do, is make itself a target with white light at night. But they had these dustpan lighting on there to help see the deck and see if this would be good for pilots. And I did the trials on that with another pilot, flying from ashore out at night to the carrier. It was coming up the American coast, and we used to fly out each night, do trials for a couple of hours, and then come back and just have enough gas to get back ashore, spend the night, refuel, go up the coast a little further, and do the same thing the next night. So we did this for about 3 nights. That's quite an interesting test. And that white lighting was really very nice. Well, in 1968, while I was still in VX-10, the Canadian government, the Liberal government, with a defense minister called Mr. Hellyer, and one can read books about Mr. Hellyer, created what they call unification of the armed services. The Royal Canadian Navy no longer existed. The Royal Canadian Air Force no longer existed. These were all changed to the Canadian Armed Forces, Maritime Command for Navy, Air Command for the Air Force. Well, actually, no, Air Command didn't start up until 1975. The Air Force became fractured. The Maritime Air Component, Long Range Maritime Patrol, actually became part of Maritime Command, part of the Navy. The fighter group remained as a fighter command of its own. Transport Command remained a fighter, and Tactical Aviation was part of the Army. The Air Force became fractured. It was quite a sad tale for the Air Force, actually. In 1975, a gentleman, an officer by the name of General Carr, finally recreated the Air Force as an entity. And while they still worked operationally for the Navy and NORAD and the Army, they were as one unit for standards and training and that sort of thing, which they should have been all along. Why it was fractured for 7 years, I don't have the answer. But it was recreated in 75, and that's the way it exists today. It was not called the Royal Canadian Air Force. It's called Canadian Armed Forces Air Command. That's the official name of the Air Force. Well, in 68, we unified, and the Air Force, the different components now, singular components of the Air Force, took over all aviation. Naval aviation ceased to exist on the 1st of February, 68. Didn't mean we stopped flying from the carrier, because it still stayed in service from 1970, but we're all now considered Air Force personnel, even though we had joined the Navy. All aviation, Navy aviation, Army aviation, now became all part of Air Command. So, or part of what was the individual components, which in 75 became Air Command. And we were all put into a green uniform. Everybody in the Armed Forces, Navy, Army, and Air Force, were all put into a green uniform. It took about 2-3 years to get into the uniform, but it all opened me up. Which also meant that we weren't restricted to just Navy flying anymore. So when I was posted in 69, a year later, from VX-10, I asked to go fly the Long Range Maritime Patrol aircraft at Greenwood, Nova Scotia. So there I went to Greenwood, Nova Scotia, to fly the Argus Long Range Patrol aircraft. Now this aircraft had a duration of 18 hours, could fly 18-hour patrols. So we had a crew and a half on board, 15-man crew, 3 pilots, 2 flight engineers, and then navigators and sensor operators on the back of the airplane. Large aircraft, 4-engine, large airplane. So I flew there for 5 years till 75, And had a few incidents. One of the things that occurred to me there was that I flew with every Royal Air Force. We had a British exchange officer in the squadron, and I flew with every one of them. When I was a co-pilot, I flew with Scott Anderson, the crew commander who was over from Britain. And then when I was a crew commander, the next two exchange officers all started their tour with me as my co-pilot. That's apropos of nothing really, but the Brits really sent over good pilots. They were really good. I recall one incident with Scott Anderson. I was his co-pilot, and we were flying on a patrol to the mid-Atlantic. We were supposed to return to Greenwood, and we launched a sonobuoy, which is an acoustic sensor device you put in the water to listen for noise. Usually we're looking for Soviet submarines. That was our main purpose in life, flying that airplane. And we used to track Soviet submarines a great deal and do surveillance on the Soviet fleet. Remember, this is all part of the Cold War era, you know, 1960s and 70s. And launching one of these sonobuoys, it got stuck going out, and the vanes that come out to slow it down as it falls, it acts like a parachute. These steel metal vanes were twisting, and they cut the bottom of the aircraft, and they cut one of our controls that control the elevator of the airplane, the horizontal stabilizer. That's the, as people call the tail of the airplane, but the one that sticks sideways, not the one that's vertical. The vertical is called the vertical stabilizer. The other one, horizontal, is like a small wing. It's called the horizontal stabilizer. And it cut our controls and jammed them, so we couldn't change the attitude of the aircraft, the pitch of the aircraft, up or down. But we still had trim control. So we had minor control of the pitch attitude of the airplane. So we declared an emergency, a mayday, and the United States Air Force had a search and rescue squadron in the Azores, flying Hercules airplanes. They launched the Hercules, and instead of us coming back to Canada, our closest airfield was in fact the Azores. So we turned for the Azores, declared a mayday, donned our immersion suits for entering the water. We had survival suits on the airplane, but we didn't normally wear them. That's the first time and the only time I've ever put them on in that long-range airplane. By the way, in the trackers, we used to fly with them all the time over the ocean. We always wore them. In the long-range patrol airplane, you can get up and walk around. In the tracker, you couldn't do that. Once you sat in the airplane, you were there for 4 hours. In the Argus, for 18 hours, we even had a couple of bunks in the airplane, and we had crew rest area and that sort of thing. We prepared meals and, you know, we took meals, everything. It was an 18-hour airplane. We had cooking facilities and that sort of thing. Anyway, we were intercepted about an hour and a half later by this Hercules, and it escorted us into the Azores, and we did a very long radar approach to the Azores, manipulating our attitude with power and the small elevator trim, and landed successfully. Fortunately, the weather was good, and we didn't have any problems getting in, but it was a scary moment. That's part of that 2% of stark terror. In about 73, I was now a crew commander, and I had a British exchange officer as my first officer. But there was a fish war going on with Britain and Iceland. They were having a very, very serious fish war. So it was inappropriate to take a British officer into Iceland. So I had to get a different co-pilot from time to time. Because we used to fly to Iceland a lot. And you'll find on my bio the countries that I visited in long range. We used to go to Iceland a lot, and Norway, and Britain, and the Azores, and Bermuda, and Puerto Rico, and the east coast of the United States. And in the Arctic, you know, we did a lot of flying all around the North Atlantic. So I had another Canadian as my first officer. When I took the commander of the air group, a brigadier general, into Iceland on a patrol, the wind was very bad crosswind in Iceland, and that day, and Iceland is a pretty treacherous place to go in the wintertime. Anyway, it's just what it's called, Iceland. It was icy and windy and crosswind. and it blew four tires on the landing. It was, the general wanted to land the airplane. He hadn't flown since the war, but when he became posted to this command position, he did a small checkout on the Argus to familiarize himself, and he felt that he could fly the airplane. He wasn't really qualified, but he wanted to land. And I was only a captain at the time, two stripes, and he was a brigadier general. Fortunately, I had my commanding officer on board the airplane, who was a navigator, so he wasn't flying the airplane, and the assistant chief of staff, who was the general's colonel, and both of them thought that I had done the right thing. I didn't let the general land. I landed, but I blew four tires on this big crossing, because the Argus had a very bad crosswind limitation. It was very poor in crosswind. So anyway, we got the airplane fixed okay, and then we flew home. And when we were coming home, of course, the headquarters was in Halifax, and Greenwood is about 15 minutes away by Argus, and they wanted to be dropped off. He and his chief of staff wanted to be dropped off in Shearwater. So we approached Shearwater, and he wanted to do the landing. Well, the weather wasn't too bad, so I said, okay. And, you know, what do you do when a general says, I want to do the landing? He shouldn't be doing it with a crew on board when he's really not qualified. So he does the approach to the landing, and we get close to the runway, and he isn't nearly set up as good as he should be. So I'm in the right seat now, because as captain of the aircraft, I have to be in one of the two seats. So I take control from him, I take over the airplane, I do an overshoot and call the engineer for power. In the Argus, we had a flight engineer. And he handled the power mostly, except when you're actually on the runway. So I call for an overshoot. I go around again. I get the general all set up on the approach, and I say, okay, you have control. Okay, let's do this again. So he brings the airplane down. Halfway down, he doesn't do the pre-landing check. So I take over the airplane again. I do the pre-landing check. I give it back to him. I said, okay, you're all set for the landing, you know, basically without saying it. So all you got to do is touch the airplane down, get the power off, and, you know, get on the brakes. Anyway, he rounds out the airplane, doesn't get the power off. He's not calling the power off. We're going to float down the runway till they run off the end. So I immediately take over the airplane. There's a very strict procedure in piloting. You know, you say, if you give control, you say, you have control, and the other guy says, I have control. If I take control, I say, I have control, and he has to acknowledge, you have control. I don't think he acknowledged. I just says, I have control, and I took control of the airplane, called the power off, landed the airplane, got on the brake, put into reverse quickly, and we stopped just at the end of the runway. And Shearwater's got a long runway, 9,000 feet. We only need about 6,000. But I landed right at the end of the runway. I'm just sweating at this point. And I said, boy, nobody should ever be put in this position with a general and a young captain like myself. Well, I wasn't a young captain. I was a pretty experienced captain. Captain in rank and captain of the aircraft. Anyway, we taxied the airplane back in, and the airplane said, thanks very much. He got out. I think the general knew that he really hadn't done a very good job. Fortunately for me, my CO was on board, and the chief of staff, who had been my base commander at Greenwood before this, both of them came out to me and said, you did a really good job. You did the right thing. He said, that was good. 6 months later, I got promoted, so I think it did me a lot of good. I thought I was going to get crucified, actually, for the four tires that I blew in Iceland. But I think I recovered by taking over control from the general on the landings in Shearwater. So that takes us back there. I ended my career, ended my flying in Greenwood basically by going on the Arctic Survival Course in February of 75. And on the Arctic Survival Course, you have to build an igloo and live in it for a few days. I won't get away from that machine too far, but I want to show you this picture. There's the igloos that we built on Arctic Survival on Cornwallis Island near Resolute in Northwest Territories. And I think Resolute is part of Nunavut now, actually. And there's us building igloos. So I thought you might like to see that little picture. And actually, that's me. And that's called a fighter trench. When you haven't got time to build an igloo, and if you had to bail out and you're only alone, you'd build a kind of an A-frame just to protect you from the wind. And that's what I was doing there.
Okay, that's amazing.
I gave that lecture to my son-in-law's school class out at Souk when he was teaching out at Souk here last year. He gave a lecture on how to build. They were doing northern studies, and I told them how to even build an igloo. and live in it. I lived in it for a week.
Oh.
It's quite an experience living in an igloo.
Well, what is that experience like? Is it, I don't know what it is.
It was minus 50. Temperature was minus 50. And it was, you'd be amazed. You can live, you can survive, and you can be comfortable. It's absolutely amazing. And in fact, that's why you take the survival courses, you know, to teach you that in fact, you can do it, you can be comfortable, and if you know the little tricks about building an igloo, it's really very simple, but you have to know these little tricks, how to keep it together, how to build it, and that you actually can live in it comfortably. And we did a lot of Arctic patrols, you see. These sovereignty patrols were a big thing in the 70s and 80s, and we always wanted to have somebody on the crew that had an Arctic survival course. In case you ever went down, somebody knew how to build an igloo and how to survive in the Arctic. So it was very important. Okay, from there I went to Toronto in 75 for 3 years. As a major now, I went to Command and Staff College, which is Senior Officers Command and Staff College, majors being the junior of the senior officers. Not general officers, senior officers are majors, lieutenant colonels and colonels. And went to Command and Staff College for a year, which is, you know, very intense studies on higher level staff duties, so that you can work in a headquarters and plan exercises and plan warfare if necessary, that sort of thing. In there we visited New York, the United Nations headquarters, and listened to several ambassadors talk to us. We visited several U.S. bases in the States, missile bases, marine bases, all sorts of places to get a flavor of how the NATO nations worked. And we even went to Europe and visited the Canadian forces in Europe and the German forces in Europe. All really, really very interesting, very educational. After finishing the year at Staff College, the syndicate director said, I was selected to stay in Toronto and teach for 2 years. Nobody wants to stay in Toronto for an extra year. It's a big city and it's really all wall-to-wall concrete. But I was selected. It turned out actually to be an extremely good tour, even though I didn't particularly want to stay there for another 2 years. And that was as a syndicate director, which is teaching junior officers staff duties, because we had a junior officer staff school in Toronto. We had a command and staff college for senior officers and a staff school for junior officers. And I was teaching them staff duties for 2 years. And actually, it was a very good job. So, looking after the fact, I was very glad that I did that job, because it taught me how to be a good staff officer. More than just going to staff college myself, teaching it, you learn more than the students do. And very interesting, while I was there, we had foreign students there periodically, and I had a student from Trinidad and Tobago, I had a student from Ghana, and I had a student from Malawi. These were all part of Canada's, I don't know what you call it, not just Africa, aid to Africa, because Trinidad and Tobago was involved as well, but I guess it was Commonwealth. All of these are Commonwealth countries, and aid to Commonwealth militaries. And these people had to go to our staff school. It's a 3-month intensive staff training, staff procedures for Canadian military officers, junior military officers, but staff training for these people. And then they went to our Army Staff College, which is 6 months in Kingston, Ontario, where they learned how to do plan Army exercises and do Army staff work, because they were all Army people. Okay, after we finished Toronto in 78, I went to Comox, British Columbia on Vancouver Island from 78 to 84 for 6 years. Once again, that squadron, 407 squadron, I was flying the Argus aircraft, which I had flown at Greenwood for 5 years. I was back on the Argus, so it was just like duck soup, you know. And I became the operations officer right away as a major. I was the operations officer. We did flying all around the Pacific, Aleutian Islands, Hawaii, west coast of the United States, and again, Arctic flying as well, still doing patrols in the Arctic. We phased out the Argus in the East Coast in 1980, and in Green and Comox in 1981, replaced it with the Aurora patrol aircraft. And the Aurora is basically this, very similar to the American P-3 Orion aircraft, which they had in service from the early 60s and still in service today. But our airframe was the same, but the internals were different. Inside the airplane, we rebuilt it into a Canadianized version, a much different arrangement inside with different equipment. And it was a very good airplane. It's still in service today. It's 26 years old now, and it right now it's going through its sort of modernization program, major modernization rebuild going on the Aurora right today, 2006. Yeah. I was the last operations officer with the Argus and did the planning for the introduction of the Aurora. And in 81, of course, I thought I was going to get transfer from the Argus to the Aurora. I got promoted, which means I had to leave the squadron because there's already one lieutenant colonel in the squadron, and our squadrons only have one lieutenant colonel, and he's the commanding officer. So I had to leave the squadron. But we must have had a really smart career manager in Ottawa because he put me on the French course, and I did 4 months of French training in Comox, and went to Saint-Jean, Quebec for 4 months, and did 4 months of French training there. So I did an 8-month French course, which was very common for senior officers in the military, you know, the French language training, and got posted back to the squadron to be the CO designate. It still wasn't, the old CO's term wasn't still up. But then I got sent to Greenland from Comox to do a 4-month conversion course under the Aurora. So while there was still was a CO, halfway through my course, I came back to the squadron on a 3 or 4 day break, and took command of the squadron, and then went to Greenland to finish the course, and then came back to Comox as the CO of the squadron. So I was the CO of the squadron for the second and third year that the Aurora was in service. After I had done all the planning of the introduction to the airplane as the ops officer phasing out the Argus, I thought I was going to still stay in the squadron as a major, and I got promoted. But I mean, it couldn't have worked out better. Came back in as a CO a year later. It was just superb. While I was the CO of the squadron, we took the Aurora to the Aleutian Islands, Hawaii, west coast of the United States, and I did a tour to Japan with the airplane. On the way back from Japan, did a very interesting trip from Japan to Guam. In Guam, we did what we call a Carolinas patrol. It was the Carolina Islands, and the Americans had a detachment of P-3s in there, and we did one of their patrols for them. And they patrol the islands to see, lots of times the storms go through, and people get stranded on little islands which are uninhabited. And you have to go and investigate all these islands all the time to see if anybody's stranded there looking for help. So we did about a 10-hour patrol from Guam to Guam. And then Guam to Hawaii, that's a real long leg, right over midway to Hawaii. I don't know, I think that was about an 11-hour trip. That's a long flight. Pacific Ocean is huge, twice as big as the Atlantic. Huge ocean. And then Hawaii back to Comox. Well, that's a short trip. That's only 7 hours. While the Argus was an 18-hour airplane, you could do 18-hour patrols in it, the Aurora is basically a 10-hour patrol airplane. You could stretch it a little by shutting down engines, but it's basically 10 to 11 hours. But the advantage of the Aurora is that it's almost twice as fast as the Argus. So while you have a shorter duration, to get to your operational area, you can get there twice as fast as the Argus did, stay almost as long on patrol, and then get home twice as fast as the Argus did. On the East Coast, for example, it would take us often 5 hours to get to Mid-Atlantic to do a 6-hour patrol, or 7 or 8 hour patrol, and then 5 hours to get home, or maybe 6 hours to get home because you're going west into the wind. That's a hell of a long transit. The Aurora's transit was half that. And you can stay on task for 6 hours, 5 to 6 hours on task, and be much more effective with a much, much more updated detection equipment on board and everything. So this Aurora airplane is a real beauty. High, fast, pressurized, much quieter, much more comfortable. Beautiful airplane. I was just thrilled to spend my last flying tour flying the Aurora. As a lieutenant colonel, you only usually get one flying tour, and that's as the CO of the squadron. After that, they don't need lieutenant colonels flying. That's for captains and majors.
Right.
After 47th Squadron and Comox, I went to MARPAC headquarters in Victoria from 84 to 86 as the senior air officer, as a lieutenant colonel. Today, there's a colonel there, but there wasn't when I was there. I was the senior airman for Rear Admiral Yano. And after 2 years there as the senior air officer on staff, I was promoted to colonel. So then that's the rank I retired in. So, obviously the CO's job in Comox was good to me, and the staff job in MARPAC was very good to me. After MARPAC for 2 years, I went, as a colonel, I went back to Halifax on the East Coast to Maritime Command Headquarters. Remember, that's what the Navy's now called. Maritime Command. And I was deputy commander of Maritime Air Group. So I was in an Air Force Air Group position. Remember, the Air Force was reformed in 75, and then they had air groups, a fighter group, transport group, tactical group of the Army, and Maritime Air Group that worked for the Navy, but was really part of the Air Force. Operationally, they worked for the Navy, do long-range patrol with long-range aircraft, helicopters on board, destroyers at sea, but it's an Air Force organization that's operationally does the Navy's air work for them. So I was deputy commander of the Maritime Air Group for 4 years, 86 to 90. It's a killer of a job. Normally you're in the job no more than 3 years, but the commander changed after 3 years, and they wanted me to overlap to stay an extra year, so I did. As the deputy commander of Maritime Air Group, basically I was administering the four bases. There were four maritime patrol, maritime bases with maritime aircraft. Shearwater in, right there in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Summerside and Prince Edward Island, which actually closed at the end of my tour. Summerside closed as an air base. Greenwood, Nova Scotia, which is our big East Coast base still today. And Comox and Bank Around, which still retains our patrol squadron. And a big part of the job was providing helicopter support to the fleet. The ships that carry helicopters all carry what used to be Navy helicopters, but are now Air Force helicopters since 1968. And those helicopters actually, they've been trying to replace them for 20 years. They're actually in the process now. I think 2007, the first Cyclone will replace the Sea King. The Cyclone is the new airplane that Sikorsky is building. Sikorsky built the Sea Kings as well, so Sikorsky is replacing its own airplanes. It's a good thing, too. It looks like a good airplane. In 1990, I left Halifax and got posted to my last job, which was at Training Systems Headquarters. Canadian Forces has a training system. They don't call it a command, they call it a training system. And it was headquartered in Trenton. It moved after I left in 92. It moved the headquarters to Borden, Ontario. When I was there, it was still in Trenton on the base. Nothing to do. Trenton is basically the large transport base for our Air Force. But the training systems headquarters was there just as a larger unit, occupying a headquarters building, and nothing to do with transport work or anything. And as a training headquarters, we administered five bases in Canada. Chilliwack, which doesn't exist anymore. Actually, Chilliwack still exists. It provides small support to reserve units and a variety of other things, but it's not a training base anymore like it used to be. Borden, which is still a very, very large training base. Most of the trades training in the Navy is done at Borden, or in the Air throughout the service. Most of it's done. Actually, the Navy does a lot at its two coasts, but there's a lot of basic trades training done at Borden. Kingston, Ontario, Saint-Jean, Quebec, and Cornwallis. And Cornwallis doesn't exist anymore. It's been closed out. I don't know if my contact with all these bases had anything to do with the fact that they're now closed. Summerside's closed, Chilliwack's gone, Cornwallis is gone. So I provided support to those bases as the Chief of Staff Operations, and I did base inspections to make sure that their standards of their operations, emergency services, ranges, firing ranges, explosive ordnance, because they're training bases, they do a lot of explosives training and ammunition training, you know, small arms training and that sort of thing. So it was important that these training areas and such were all inspected and maintained proper standards. So that was my last job. In 1992, I went on retirement leave, bought a house in Victoria, and moved here, and officially retired on April 10th, 1993. And that's just about the end of that story. I'm married to a lady from Halifax, my wife, Molly Rogers. We got married in 62, and we had two daughters. Sheila was born in 66 while we were in Nova Scotia, and Elaine, born in 1970 while we were in Nova Scotia. But both of them are graduates of the University of Victoria. And that's like the end of the story.
Going back to your sea duty when you were aboard ships, what was the camaraderie like aboard ship among pilots and among pilots with other servicemen?
Well, of course, that's not the cadet days, eh? Because we were just cadets in the training crew. So we're right. Talking about on the carrier.
Yes, on the carrier.
The ship's officers and the air crew worked totally different schedules.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, there wasn't as much intermingling as you would expect when on the same ship. And you have to remember, on a carrier, you know, there's lots of us. You know, you're not there like on a destroyer. There's only maybe 14 officers or 12 or 14 officers. But everybody knows each other well, and everybody's working in the same routine. On a carrier, the ship's officers are working a normal ship's routine. You know, there's a 7-watch system, okay? 5 4-hour watches and 2 2-hour watches, which make, you have to have an odd number of watches so that you don't do the same rotation every day, you see? If you have a 3-watch system, you're on watch every third time. If you have an even number, like 6, you're doing the same watch every day. If somebody else is doing the lousy watches at midnight and you're doing the good ones in the afternoon, and that's not fair. So you have to have an odd number. And that's why you tumble over. You never stand the same watch every day with an odd system. With the air crew, you're not on that watch system. We're on a flying schedule. We're either doing the morning launch, the afternoon launch, or the night launch. And if we're doing sustained operations, it's running over 24 hours a day. So every fourth flight, you're on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it could, you know, you may be on the morning, and then you may be on the next day. You may be on at midnight that same day, and then, you know, it just tumbles over. So you're never on the same schedule as the ship's company officers. You're not eating at the same times as they are in many cases. So your intermingling is more done when you're in harbor. And then everybody's relaxed, and you all eat breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning, and so you meet them and all that sort of thing. And you do get to know them. But you don't get to know them well because you never work on the same schedule.
Okay.
With rare exception, when they say, because the operations staff will be briefing you all the time, and that ship's mm-hmm. company operations. So they're working the air crew schedule, because they're briefing the air crew and debriefing the air crew. And they're working the air crew schedule. But the people who are running the ship, you know, the engineering and electrical and supply and all that, they're working same as they would on a destroyer. They're working a normal ship. In fact, that becomes annoying at times because, you know, the supply department wants to be open 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, just like they would ashore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the air crew may need a pair of gloves at midnight. So it doesn't work. So they have to adjust their schedule to meet, you know, remember why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a bit of friction sometimes between the Air Corps. And I'm not saying it was bad or anything. I'm just saying sometimes you have to remind the ship's company why they're there. They're there to get those airplanes off and back again. And they don't operate the same schedule you do. And it doesn't affect the officers so much because they have much better accommodation at it. But the technical people and the backseat operators, they're living in mess decks where the ship's routine wants the mess deck to be cleaning stations 7 in the morning or 7:30 in the morning. You know, they don't have maids on board the ship. So you got to clean your own mess decks. Meal times are at a certain time. It does not have the air crew. And we have non-commissioned air crew. And it doesn't work for the aviation technicians who are fixing your airplanes. Because they may be working through the meal hour, and they may have to eat breakfast at 10 in the morning, and not between 6 and 7:30. And they might not be available for cleaning stations at 8 o'clock. They may be fixing airplanes at 8 o'clock. So they may be free at 11 o'clock to do cleaning stations. So there's always the difficulty to get the aviation branch routine to fit in with the ship's routine. And you're constantly reminding the ship's people, the XO of the ship, who is almost never an airman, always reminding them, hey, your schedule does not meet our requirements. And our requirements are there to do what this ship is all about. It's there to get airplanes in the air and back on the ground again, or on the deck. It's not there just to sail from A to B. So you get along, but you always have a little bit of friction, reminding that the aviator's routines and the technical people with the aviation branch have a totally different requirement, different routine than the standard Navy routine. I could also add that this is seldom a big problem in the United States Navy, because in the United States Navy, the senior drivers of carriers are aviators. They make an aviator in charge of a carrier. And in our Navy, we never had enough senior aviators to be in charge of the carrier. Sometimes you have the CO, the carrier was in fact an aviator, but rarely the XO. And it's the XO that runs the ship's routine, not the captain of the ship. The captain of the ship has a big influence on his XO, of course, and they should be able to lay down the law. Because I remember we did have a couple of aviators who were the COs of the carrier and of our carrier. But again, they say it's the XO that runs the ship, and you really sometimes have to have some heart-to-heart with the people who are running the ship.
And with training, you had said that sometimes you guys went down to the American carriers and were trained there, and you got to learn their system, and you taught the Canadian system. How different were how they were run?
Not significantly different, but secondly, it wasn't for training. We did some up till 59, when my class trained with the Air Force. The first three classes of this program where we trained large groups of aviators, first three classes went to the U.S. Navy actually for their aviation training to get their wings. But the trips to the U.S. Navy that I was talking about after I was trained there in the 60s, we call that cross-deck training, which isn't really training.
Okay.
It's cross-deck operations. We were not in the training mode then at all. Now, we didn't go there for training. We did there for cross-deck familiarization well, when you do an exercise, you always call them training exercises because it's not a war. Okay. So an exercise is a training evolution. But it's not training you to be an aviator. It's not training you to do carrier work. You're trained. You're just there doing cross-deck evolutions, learning their procedures, implementing NATO standard procedures. You may find that the Americans implement them a little differently. So we get to know each other's procedures so that when we have to work together, we can. We understand each other. Remember, there's an old adage in the military, You will fight the way you train. And you could do the same thing. You can translate that philosophy to civilian life just as easily. If you've never driven on a high-speed auto route, for example, the first time you're on it, it's very unfamiliar. So you shouldn't be driving a school bus on a auto route with a busload of children the first time you were on that auto route. Somebody should have taken you on that auto route and shown you how you drive on an auto route, how the expressway, the entrances and exits are, the ramps and all that. And then when you get familiar with it and you're comfortable, then you can put children in the back of your bus and say, now I'm not qualified to drive on an auto route.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's exactly the same in the military, except it's extremely important in the military. You don't take soldiers to Afghanistan to fight if they've never, ever trained in a situation similar to what they're facing. You try and simulate. In Wainwright, Alberta today, they have built an Afghan village. And all the troops, before they go to Afghanistan, go there for 6 months of training. 6 months of training to face built-up in combat in built-up areas, they called it. They have to practice combat in built-up areas. How to enter built-up areas. How to surveil them from the outside. How to do all this. Because you don't want to throw them into a combat situation first time, never having been exposed to this in a training environment. There's going to be surprises when they hit the combat one, but not as bad as it's going to be if they've done training that tries to approximate what they're going to face in war. I mean, you can't actually simulate wartime for real. You know, real bullets coming at you for the first time is going to be a shock because you can't do that in training. But you have to practice as much as possible as close. When we're flying, you're tracking a Soviet submarine. We fly at 300 feet just as if it was wartime. We're ready to drop our weapon. The only thing we didn't do is actually release the torpedo. The only thing we didn't do. Day, night, all weather. We flew down there at 300 to 500 feet at our weapon drop altitude all the time. If a war ever broke out, it wouldn't be new to us. We have done it before. We know it's safe to do. It's just like building an igloo in the Arctic. I could go to the Arctic and feel very comfortable that I could survive. I didn't have to survive then because if we ever ran into a bad situation, the instructors lived in a NATCO trailer. We were living in igloos that we had built. And we know we can do it because we did it. And we lived in them. We can't. So if we ever had to crash in the Arctic, I know I can build an igloo and I know I can live in it. War fighting is the same thing. You will fight the way you train. If you train for the maximum, you can fight to the maximum. If you train to the minimum, you won't be very good when the chips are down.
By the sounds of that, it sounds like you believe that your training definitely prepared you for your future career and what you had to do then.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. And now you talked about doing your recalls, or requalifications anyways. How often did you have to do that if there was a certain time period you weren't flying for that you then had to go and recall?
No, you only recalled if down the road,
mm-hmm.
you recall. There's various types of recall.
Okay.
For example, annually we recalled on small arms. Everybody's got to be able to defend themselves. So, you know, we always recalled on small arms, pistol and rifle. Virtually everybody in the military does that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an annual requirement, okay? Now, for the carrier recall, you only do that if you're intending to go to the carrier for operations.
Okay.
Okay? If you're not going there for the next 5 years, you don't recall until time is up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Recall in that particular mode means you do things on a benign day, not in bad weather, not when it's, you know, if it circumstances are difficult weather-wise and such. You're doing it in order to get yourself re-familiarized, say, you know, I'm going to requal, and we want to, actually, it was a piece of, once you've done it, carrier landing, it's like riding a bicycle, once you're experienced. I mean, I could probably do it, well, I think I could go and do it tomorrow. There'd be nothing unfamiliar. And it's familiarity that that you really, really need. You got to be familiar, and you got to remember the procedures. So we were only doing it so that when we went to Bonaventure, she came out of refit, we were all get qualified.
Okay. What was your favorite aircraft out of the ones that you flew? Is there one that you preferred more than the other?
That's an interesting question, because at the time I was flying them, each of them have their strengths and very few weaknesses. The tracker aircraft on the carrier was the right airplane at the right time for that particular size of carrier, and it was safe. It wasn't comfortable. It was terribly cramped, and once you got into it, your 4 hours to 4.5 hour flights, you know, you were locked in there, and if you had to pee or something, you did it through a tube, and you know, you couldn't move. And eating food in there was a box lunch, and some of us used to carry a thermos so we could have a hot cup of coffee, and that was it. But it was a very safe airplane, very rugged airplane. And if you're going to carrier fly, you want a safe, rugged airplane, and you couldn't have a better one than the Tracker. But to say that it was a favorite because, you know, of other things like comfort or whatever have you, that didn't meet the bill. But boy, safety is a very, very, that's a top of your priority when you're flying off carriers. I guarantee you, safety is a top priority. And you couldn't ask for a better airplane. So that has got to be a top-notch airplane. Now, when I went to fly the Argus, four-engine airplane, it was a bit of a pig. It was heavy on the controls. It was a lumbering giant. It was noisy, but it was safe, too. So it wasn't a favorite from the point of view of, you know, comfort physically. You know, I wear earplugs and hearing aids. I wear hearing aids now mostly because of the Argus. Really noisy. We didn't have good sound suppression on our ears in those days. They have much better ones now, but we didn't have in those days. They don't need as much now because they don't have as noisy an airplane. But it was a safe airplane, and that was a good thing. It was a safe airplane. But noisy, it wasn't pressurized, so it always flew. Above 10,000 feet, you have to go on oxygen. Okay, that's a standard, because the air gets thinner. And, you know, we only had portable oxygen, so wherever came to the West Coast to fly over the mountains, you have to go on oxygen. Fortunately, in Comox, the mountains aren't high enough on the island. You don't have to go on oxygen to get over top to get out to the Pacific Ocean. See, they only go up to 7,000. So you don't have to go over 10,000 to get over the mountains. But you have to if you're going east with the airplane. So while it was a very safe airplane, and I was very comfortable in the safety of that airplane, it was a noisy, heavy airplane. And it had one serious drawback. It had a very unusual control system. It had a floating control system, which required a lot of air pressure over the wings for the controls to work properly. And just at about the round out as you landed, your wings just, the control surface just flopped down. There wasn't enough air to keep them effective. And you were kind of at the mercy. You better have that airplane in the right landing position, because you couldn't make any changes once you reached the rounded out to touchdown. Yeah. So it was a bit tricky. And it had a very, very small crosswind limitation. 17 knots at 90 degrees. That's very, very low for an effective airplane. In some places, it's okay if you've got lots of cross runways, you know. But you might go to some out of the way places that's got one runway and the wind is 90 degrees to the runway. If the wind is over 15 knots, you are in trouble. That's why I blew tires in Iceland. They didn't have cross runways then. They built more since. But they didn't have cross runways. And I had a very high crosswind, and I didn't have any place else to go. I was going to Iceland, the coming hell or high water. The Aurora now that replaced it. If there's a favorite, it's got to be the Aurora. It's high, it's fast, It's pressurized. It's comfortable. It's a big cockpit. It's built by Lockheed. Lockheed builds airplanes with big cockpits. Hercules airplane is a Lockheed airplane. Big cockpit. The Aurora, nice, big, comfortable cockpit. It's quiet, quieter. Not really quiet, but it's quieter than anything else I've flown. It's high, it's fast, it's pressurized. You can walk around in it. You can get something to eat. It's got a galley. Aurora's it. Aurora's the favorite airplane.
Now, when you flew, did you prefer doing visual flying or instrument flying, or was it a combination?
Oh, I think everybody prefers visual flying. Mm-hmm. That's fun, you know, see and be seen, that's fun. But all of those airplanes were good instrument airplanes. All of them were good instrument airplanes. Very, very good. And Aurora, outstanding, actually. Aurora's outstanding. But all of them has good instrument capability. Good instrument, good all-weather. They were good in all-weather.
You had also mentioned wind finding techniques. Can you describe those? Or?
Yeah. You didn't need that on the Argus and the Aurora because it had it had electronic systems to find the wind for you. You know, you had Doppler radar on board. Right. That fed you the wind all the time. And it integrated the airspeed into the Doppler and it told you that you never ever had the wind find. In a tracker, you had none of that. So, as long as the weather was reasonably good and you were flying low, below 1,000 feet, the wind at 1,000 feet doesn't change much from the surface. As you go above 1,000, it starts to change. You can have a wind 40 degrees different from the surface wind quite easily. And remember, at sea, it's not like over land. You see, over land, topography affects the direction of the wind a lot. You see, between mountain valleys, and right here in Victoria is a good example. Wind goes up and down the Strait of Georgia, but at 5,000 feet, it can be 90 degrees to that because it's over top of the mountains and it's flowing in a different direction. But as it gets lower, it has to follow the valleys. At sea, there's no topography. So the wind is relatively constant as you go up, at least for a few thousand feet. So we always tried to fly 1,000 feet and below. And that's where you're most effective with when you're looking for submarines that are snorting or have a periscope up and your radar. They're small targets. You've got to be low, and you want your radar to be grazing the surface, not looking down at it. Because if you're looking down at it, you pick up a lot of wave clutter. So you want to be as low as possible. 300 to 500 feet we used to fly all the time. And when you're down below when you're down at 500 feet, your wind is the same as the surface. You get good at reading the surface wind. You can see the wind lanes. You can see which way the wind is blowing, and by the amount of white caps, you can actually estimate the speed of the wind. And the novice wouldn't, but when you've been doing this for years, you can read it to within 3 or 4 knots, actually. Very good. Mm-hmm. Now, at night, you can't see it. And we flew day night. Okay, there is a technique. You start a rate one turn. You drop a smoke float. And a smoke float has an orange flame on it. Okay. In the daytime, you see the smoke. At night, you see the flame. You don't see the smoke, but you see the flame. And you have to be low because you have to be able to come right back over top of that. If you're really high, you can't tell what on top is. So you're really low, you can. So you drop the smoke, and at 500 feet is easy. You drop the smoke. You do a turn. When you're finished, come back on the same heading you started. You drop another smoke. Okay? There's a formula. The distance between the two, you can calculate a formula over the time it took you to turn to give you the wind speed. The direction one to the other, the second one to the first, is the direction the wind is blowing from. Because it will always blow you downwind as you're doing that turn. That one's easy. The formula is a little less easy to figure out the wind speed. But you can figure it out. And you time yourself flying from one to the other, and that gives you, you can calculate the wind speed. Mm-hmm. So every, at night, about once an hour, we would do a wind finding circuit. Because if we don't know the wind, we can't navigate accurately. Because remember, we're doing dead reckoning navigation. Mm-hmm. It's not electronic. In a tracker. difference in the Argus and the Aurora long-range patrol boat. They've got navigation systems and a Doppler radar which gives them the wind and feeds it into your navigation system. You never have to wind find. But in the tracker, we always wind found, at night especially. In the daytime, we usually just did it by eyeball. And I don't know anybody ever got lost. Except that night flight they went to Brazil and had to ditch. And me almost. But again, that was because we weren't down below to do infighting. We had to fly 9,000 feet. And we were on an IFR clearance from New York Oceanic. So we had to stay up there. No way to find the winds.
In the squadron, how many aircraft are in one squadron? Or does it change depending?
Oh, yeah, it changes. And because the armed forces are always trying to reduce and reduce and reduce and reduce, you get fewer squadrons and they get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the fewer the squadrons you have, the less overhead you have. You know, you have one CO instead of two COs. The 880 squadron that I was in had just amalgamated from two 12-plane squadrons to one 24-plane squadron. But in effect, that was 61 to 65, in effect, we worked as two squadrons. Because 12 planes and 18 crews were considered shoreside, and 12 planes and 18 crews were considered seaside. Remember I said, first year as a co-pilot was ashore, second year was at sea. So that shoreside unit went to sea in their second year. And the unit that was at sea came ashore, the co-pilots all became crew commanders all got posted out, they became the shoreside training side, we became the seaside. A year later, we switched around again. So you were, the 12 planes were switching each year, they switched.
And
that was an 880 flying trackers.
Yeah.
In VX-10, when I was in the experimental squadron, we had every airplane. We had two T-33s, we had maybe three trackers, and maybe three Sea Kings, because we were doing test and evaluation on equipment in all of the airplanes the Navy had. So we had all of those airplanes. So we only had about eight airplanes, but they were all instrumented, and we were doing test and evaluation with them. But that wasn't all the flying we did, because I was, for example, we provided the aircrew, I was doing the testing on all the airplanes that were coming back to the squadrons after being upgraded to a Mark II or a 2A or to a 3. They went through our squadron for test and evaluation and then to the operational squadron. We didn't have them on our inventory, but our squadron pilots did all the testing of them. So we weren't just restricted to flying our own squadron airplanes. We tested all the airplanes coming into the fleet.
And when your carrier was at sea, how many destroyers, you mentioned when you went to Britain that there were destroyers with you, how many accompanied the carrier?
I can't remember exactly, but it was probably no less than four to five.
And was that usually pretty standard?
That's pretty standard, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty. A carrier never sails by itself. It always has a defensive group of destroyers. They position themselves around a carrier such as to protect the carrier. Remember, it's an extremely valuable target for a submarine. They position themselves to protect, their job is to protect that destroyer from undersea, surface, and air threats. Okay, they might be positioned, a battle group, in like, we were small potatoes. I mean, you know, we would sail with four destroyers, and they're really, the escorts would be relatively close, okay, in those days. Nowadays, where ships have, in those days, missiles were just in their infancy, in the 60s. Nowadays, you're going into post-2000, or late 80s, 90s, 2000, surface ships, our surface destroyers, frigates, carry a missile that can fire 60 or 70 miles. Okay? You can't protect a destroyer by just being 10 miles away. Now you have to have picket vessels that are out 40, 50, 60 miles away, or your air units are surveilling hundreds of miles around you, all the time. Okay. That's what a carrier does. You know, the Americans don't have ASW carriers anymore. They used to have ASW carriers, then they had attack carriers. Now everything, their carriers are so big they can carry everything on one carrier. They'll have a squadron of anti-submarine airplanes. They'll have a couple of squadrons of fighter bombers. They'll have a couple of squadrons of surveillance of other refuel. They'll have refuelers. They'll have air radar picket airplanes on board. Those airplanes will go airborne. They'll have one airborne all the time if they're in a dangerous area. And he's looking around 300 miles around the carrier. They'll pick them on various locations. They won't let a surface ship of any kind come near that carrier without being carefully examined by a fighter or an airplane that can take that ship out and examine, is it a threat to the fleet or not? So their battle groups aren't made up of one carrier and four destroyers. It might be one or two carriers, and it might be 10 or 12 destroyers, or cruisers, cruiser type, light cruisers or heavy cruisers. There are no heavy cruisers anymore. There are missile-armed cruisers. And they're surveilling for hundreds of miles, because a surface enemy might be able to shoot a missile at them from 100 miles. They want to make sure that anything within 100 to 200 miles is not a threat to them. So they're surveilling out hundreds of miles, including for submarines. A lot of the destroyers are picketed way out there, and they have what they call tails. That is acoustic systems that trail behind the aircraft that are down in the water, that are listening for noise in the water, and that will detect, say, a submarine dozens and dozens of miles away. And they're examining the underwater and the surface and the air all the time. And I say, this is now just 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 miles away like we were doing with those destroyers around the carrier. They're now going out hundreds of miles.
To end our interview, just why did you decide to join the military? What was your reasoning behind it?
My reason was probably the same as about 90% of the people. There's a myth about joining the military, and we don't want to tell too many people. A lot of people think they're doing it for patriotic reasons. Mm-hmm. Most people don't join the military for patriotic reasons. There's three reasons, and patriotic is the last one. The first reason is they want a job. Mm-hmm. That's the first. It's one of the easiest places to go to get a job, and it's a good job, and it's a good career profile. You know, everybody doesn't rise to senior rank, but some of us are lucky and did, okay? Especially for people who aren't high up on the economic scale. My parents weren't well off by any stretch of the imagination. I could never have afforded to go to university, never. And I wasn't a particularly good high school student, but that was partly because of our living circumstances. There were six of us living in a four-room house. We didn't have central heating. We didn't have indoor plumbing. Even when I went to high school, I lived in a rural area that didn't have these things. A lot of people come from these backgrounds. If I could say, it's like the disadvantaged in the United States. A lot of them joined the military to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. The military provides that for you. It trains you, it educates you, and it pays you at the same time. No other company does that. You join any company, and you don't get paid. When you go to some place to get hired, they want to hire your skills. They don't want to train you. Okay. Now, there are apprenticeship programs. I know that. Okay. And that's what basically the military is. It's an apprenticeship program. They actually pay you. Just like if you join and become an apprenticeship electrician, you get a low pay as an apprentice. Your first 4 years in the military is an apprenticeship. I'm talking mostly about non-commissioned members, but it's the same for officers. Your first 4 years, if you're going to a military college, or even if you're going to a civilian university as a military cadet, you can go to civilian. You know, you're an apprentice. And for an officer, you're an apprentice longer than that, because then you have to get skills training, operational training, and all that. And, you know, your pay goes up each time as you get more skilled and you get fully qualified. for non-commissioned members in the military, their first 4 years, you get promoted to corporal automatically at 4 years. But your 4 years up to there, you're apprentice at various stages, you're getting paid, and the pay's pretty good these days, actually. It wasn't when I was there, but it's pretty good these days. At the corporal stage, 4 years, you're considered a qualified technician, you're a journeyman, okay? And so, you've got a job, they train you, they pay you while you're in training, the pay increases every year that you're in training, and every year throughout your career goes up because they have incentive pays. And then the longer you are in rank, the more you get, there is a cutoff, there may be 4 years, it might be 8 years, it might be 6 years, different rank levels. And for anybody that wants to work hard and's got the skills and shows the, you know, the ability at management levels or whatever, promotion is by merit. So people who don't merit it, don't get it. People who merit it, get it. So it's competitive, but it's by merit, not by seniority. It's not a union. And so, okay, going back to why I joined the service. A, I wasn't sure what I was going to do when I left high school. I know I couldn't go to university. I didn't, A, have the grades. B, I didn't have the financial resources to go to university. The Navy offered to educate me and train me and pay me. What more could you ask for? B, it's an adventure. There is no question that joining the military is a tremendous opportunity for adventure. And C, the last reason for patriotism, that hardly enters the picture for most people who join the military. Once they're in there, they become far more patriotic. You know, they stay in, they know they're doing some good. You hear the soldiers in Afghanistan, they'll all tell you they're doing some good. It's a, they're needed. And But that's not the reason most people join the military.
And what made you choose to become a Navy leader?
Boy, that's a really good question. It didn't dawn on me to be an aviator when I was in high school. I mean, I loved watching airplanes and all that. But when I saw this program, aviation was part of it. In fact, a very significant. The Navy, in 1954, they started this Venture Officer Training Plan. The reason they started it, the Navy all of a sudden realized, see, after the Korean War, the Navy actually started the building program. All their ships were Second World War ships. And they were going to run out of having a Navy if they didn't rebuild them. So they had a big building program of ships. And they had this carrier, which they bought in 52. They had loaned carriers from the Britain right from 46 on till 52. So 57, when Bonaventure was commissioned. They had Warrior was on loan from 46 to 48, Magnificent 48 to 57, and then Bonaventure was in, finally they bought in 42 and commissioned it in 57 to replace Magnificent and return Magnificent to the Brits. They bought the Tracker airplane in 56 to go aboard Bonaventure. It had to go on an angle deck carrier. It was no good for a straight deck. And the other carriers were all straight deck carriers. And the airplanes were for straight decks. Bonaventure was an angle deck, but needed airplanes to fit it. Trackers were the best. And thank goodness they didn't buy British airplanes, because they couldn't have got a better airplane than the Tracker. And they bought Banshees. And they were putting risk. They didn't have the people to man, coming into the service, to man the fleet that they were building, nor the air branch that was required for Bonaventure. They said, holy cow, how are we going to do this? So they rushed a program into service called the Venture Officer Training Plan of 54, which provided both the aviation officers and service officers, because we were graduating enough people to man both of these, and that was an outstanding program that did the job. Now, go back to why I became an aviator. Their brochures, it was a program to bring in aviators, but I got a brochure that said, join the Navy, be an officer, see the world, blah, 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 and I said, hey, the Navy's going to provide me with all this, let's see if I can do it. I actually had a brother in the Navy at the time, but he was a naval seaman, and I don't remember that as being any real influence on me, because I wasn't really interested in being a naval seaman. He ended up being a petty officer and when he retired, but This was a program to become an officer, and I thought that was a good idea. Besides, it's better paid, you get leadership positions, you get better educated, and then when they sent us all to the Air Force to do an aircrew selection process. That was one of the first days. We came in the door a week later, we were on an airplane out of Victoria Airport here flying to London, Ontario, and go to Centralia Aircrew to see who had the right skills, however they tested you, with psychological testing and all that. And those of us who passed that, which was probably maybe half of us, were sent to Victoria Flying Club in our senior year to get a private pilot's license. Mm-hmm. Now, probably two-thirds of the group washed out there. Those who had passed that were sent to the Air Force in 59 to do flight training. And when I passed the aircrew selection, I thought, oh, this sounds pretty good. When we got the private flying lessons, I loved it. So that basically, I was indoctrinated to become an aviator. I didn't join to become an aviator. Even though I knew that part of the program was to become pilots. I was a poor kid from the prairies. It never dawned on me that I could fly airplanes. My God, I mean, I was watching airplanes all my life. I used to live by the Edmonton Airport when I was 7, 8 years old, north of Edmonton. It never dawned on me that I could be a pilot. The Navy indoctrinated me that I could be one, and gave me the opportunity, and I grabbed onto it. That's all. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, for sitting down with us and having this great interview. I got a lot of information, so I'd like to thank you very much for partaking in our project.
It was a pleasure indeed. Pleasure.